Welcome to Virex Fiscal Year 2024 Good Data Practices Cyber Seminar Series. Thank you again to Whitney Lee at CIDR for providing technical and promotional support for this series. And thanks also to Molly Kessner, Virex Cyber Seminar Coordinator, and Linda Koch, Data Access and Policy Workgroup Lead. Virex Good Data Practices Series is being held according to the schedule listed on this slide. More information about this series and other Virex Cyber Seminars is available on Virex website, and past sessions can be viewed on HSR's Virex Cyber Seminar Archive. Virex supports VHA data users by developing and disseminating knowledge about VA data and improving the data use environment for research. The Good Data Practices Cyber Seminar Series is just one of our many tools for reaching out to VA data users throughout the field. As Molly indicated, and a quick reminder to those of you who just are signing on, slides are available for download. This is a screenshot of a sample email you should have received today before the session. In the email, you will find the link to download the slides. Before introducing our speaker today, we have two poll questions that Whitney will publish in just a moment. We look forward to getting to know our audience, and your responses do help us to do that and to plan future sessions. You will see the pop-up for those polls, as I mentioned, in a moment. The first poll question is, what is your primary role in projects using VA data? For roles in projects using VA data, the choices are you're an investigator, principal investigator, co-investigator, a statistician, methodologist, or biostatistician, a data manager, analyst, or programmer, a project coordinator, or if other, please describe that in the Q&A or chat function. And the second poll is asking, how many years of experience do you have working with VA data? And the options are none. You're brand new to this. 1 year or less, more than one or less than 3 years, at least three, but less than 7 years, at least seven and less than 10 years, and 10 years or more. And Whitney will read off those results when the voting starts to slow down. Or I should say the entry slow down.
Thank you, Joanne. The poll is open and running, and the answers are coming in quite rapidly. To our attendees, the polls are should have opened up on the right-hand side, and polls 1 and 2 are in that same panel. So please, when you are trying to make your answer choices, scroll down so that you can get all the choices for poll 2 before you hit submit. Seems like things have slowed down quite a bit, so I'm just going to go ahead and close out this poll and share the results. Hang on 1 second. All right, so for poll number 1, what is your primary role? We have 7% say A, investigator, PI, COI, 4% say B, statistician, methodologist, biostatistician, 8% say C, data manager, analyst, or programmer, 20% say D, project coordinator, and then lastly, 23% say E, others, and some of those other are regulatory coordinator, research team lead, attorney advisor, IRB administrator, RCO, and clinical RN. Poll number 2. We have, for how many years of experience, we have 8% said none, I'm brand new to this, 5% said B, 1 year or less, 17% said C, more than one, less than three, 12% said D, at least three, less than seven, 7% said E, at least 7, less than 10. And lastly, 12% said F, 10 years or more. Thank you, everyone. Back to you, Joanne.
Thanks so much, Whitney. Today's session is titled Planning for Data for a New Research Protocol. Our speaker, Tamika Jefferson, MSM, is a management and program analyst for National Data Systems, or NDS. Her background is in Privacy and the Freedom of Information Act, also known as FOIA. As an NDS team member, she is responsible for reviewing DART requests, is the point of contact for data use agreements, and works on various projects relating to national data access. Any questions that are sent through the WebEx chat box will be monitored during this talk and will be presented to Ms. Jefferson at the end of the session. For your awareness, a brief evaluation will pop up on your screen when you close or leave the session. If possible, we ask you to stay until the very end and take a few moments to complete it. Without further delay, I turn the microphone over to Ms. Jefferson. Tamika, you might be on mute.
Yes, I am. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. Today, I'm going to present to you on documentation needed and review for all DART requests. I will also discuss with you how to meet federal requirements and provide some valuable resources to assist with future DART requests. So, for this segment of the presentation, I'll be going over the documentation overview. And what this is all of the documentation that I review pertaining to your DART request. So the review of the research request memo, what I look for is that it's established that this is for preparatory research, or if it's for research alone. Also, I look for the type of requester, the type of data you're looking to access, meaning if you're looking to access real Social Security numbers. I also look for the databases that you request to use, Capri, JVL. We look for any type of external data transfers, data storage location. We also check for signatures as well. With the IRB letter, we want to make sure that there's a date that the IRB made a determination and that the IRB chair or the designee has signed off on the IRB letter. We also look for if there is a need to have an IRB continuing review. We look for the research procedures, if it fits into one or more categories. We also look for the exemption, and we also check for expiration dates as well. Those are a couple of things that we look for with the IRB approval letter. The R&D letter, we just need to know that your study was officially approved and that is signed and stamped by the R&D chair or the ACOS. The informed consent, we just look for the IRB approval, and we also look for the date stamp and the signature of approval. For the standalone HIPAA authorization, we want to make sure that the form is used correctly and that it's not mistaken for 5345, which is the third party authorization to release medical records from a veteran's request. We also look at the combined informed consent and HIPAA authorization just to make sure one is used correctly and that the required language is present. We look at the waiver because we want to make sure that you list the identifiers, data sources, and databases that you will be using and accessing for your research. And then we also look at the data use agreement to make sure that one is used properly and that the templated language is still present and that it mimics the protocol as well. So before you get to doing your research, you must make sure that the documentation that you have meets the federal requirements. studies cannot move forward unless there is a memo that is signed by the R&D chair stating that your research has been approved. You will also need to have some type of legal authority, and that legal authority will always consist of an authorization, a HIPAA waiver, a data use agreement, or a combination of them all. So here you will see that these are conditions in which you can use the combined informed consent and HIPAA authorization. And basically this document is two documents in one. One of the conditions that I want you to pay particular attention to is the second. It's the second item on this slide. And reason being is that the informed consent and HIPAA authorization is a compound document. And what that means, especially when you are getting into or the subject wants to revoke the HIPAA authorization. If you are using the informed consent and the HIPAA authorization combined form, you must clearly state that if the subject is to revoke the authorization, that is either for just for the authorization and not the informed consent, or it's for both. Because if it's not explicitly stated, then we can assume that we are revoking only the authorization portion of this form. Keep going the wrong way. My apologies. While I review the informed consent and combined HIPAA authorization, these are some of the discrepancies that I find quite often. And so with that being said, when the VHA Privacy Office decided that the informed consent and the HIPAA authorization should be a combined form, what they did, which I believe is an awesome form to have, is that they gave us a document that actually shows how to complete the form. And what that means is that the first item you see here specifically states stop. If your study consists of any type of optional component, which we see often is the future storage of data and specimens, you cannot use. I'm sorry. If not optional, you may use this form. So if nothing in your protocol is optional, if there's no optional condition, you can use this form. All of the listed items below actually gives you instructions on how to complete this form. So number three, it states clearly, red print, you should complete this information that's applicable to your project. Black or green print, It's usually not modified. However, it may be certain times where you may need to modify this information, but it will all depend on your project. And then the blue text is optional. They're just giving you some examples. So here is the template. Here's the template that you could use to assist with completing the combined informed consent and HIPAA authorization. As I stated, everything in red is to give you a description of what is needed for this specific paragraph or section. So this is the informed consent portion. A couple of pages down, you'll run into the HIPAA portion of the combined form. I circled the third paragraph or the third set of instructions under this section because at times this section is either removed or it does not include all of the information or all of the information that will be disclosed. So just make sure that when you're filling this out that you include all of the information that you will be disclosing on the subject. Do not leave anything out. As you can see, medical history, allergies, lab results, HIV, all of that is written in here. But if you see that the information that you will be disclosing is not listed, it's very important that you list that information. So the standalone HIPAA authorization, you must not confuse it with the third-party HIPAA authorization for veterans because one is for veterans and one is for research subjects. So just make sure that when you want to use a standalone authorization that you are using the correct one. Also, there is nothing in the regulations that state that you have to use the combined informed consent and HIPAA authorization form. You can split the two if you so choose to. So let's talk about the HIPAA waiver. The HIPAA waiver is your legal authority to access information without the subject's authorization. This is the only legal authority that gives you the right to access the information for research purposes. Now, we've all seen this this verbiage, and some DART requesters believe that this verbiage that is usually contained in the IRB letter satisfies the HIPAA requirement. I can confidently say that it does not after consulting with the VHA Privacy Office on several issues relating to the HIPAA waiver. Not only should your HIPAA waiver include those statements that I just presented to you, but it should also include the documentation that was reviewed to grant the HIPAA waiver. Meaning, if the HIPAA waiver was granted based on your study application. And in that study application, you've listed all of the identifiers, data sources, and databases that you that you'll be using for your study. That will suffice. If it does not, then what you will see is that you'll receive a change request via DART, and either you'll be asked for the actual HIPAA waiver and or information that was used to grant the HIPAA waiver. Oftentimes when I am communicating with DART requesters, I'm often asked the question, what are the identifiers? What you see before you is a copy of a HIPAA waiver that was retrieved from IRB.net. And this HIPAA waiver lists all of the 18 identifiers that are listed in Directive 1605.01. That's the Privacy and Release of Information Directive. So not only would you list the identifiers that you'll use for your project, you would also need to list any of the databases or data sources that you'll be using. So I'm going to jump down one to number 5. The waiver is not just to access information via VISTA or CPS or CPRS. It also includes, as you see, Vinci, CDW, CMS, and then you can also list any other data source or database that you may be using. That's why, for example, I put the Ohio Cancer Incident Surveillance System. The waiver should always consist of all of the information that you will be accessing for your project. It is not exclusive to only VISTA and CPRS. So whatever information you're requesting from DART or you're requesting in your DART request, you would also need to make sure that Vinci CDW is listed. And we also want to see the data sources that you'll be accessing as well. Last week, I processed 3 DART requests for a DART requester, and the HIPAA waiver was almost 10 pages. And the reason why is because this requester listed every single data source that they will be using for the project. So I gave you that example to show that you do not have to limit yourself when it comes to listing your data sources. We want to see what data sources you'll be using so that we'll know what you should be accessing and to make sure that we give you the proper data sources that you need. So whatever you put on the research request memo as the information that you will be requesting via DART, that same information should be included in the HIPAA waiver as well. Also, the real SSN access request memo does not replace the Social Security number questions on the HIPAA waiver. So if you use this HIPAA waiver, you must answer the Social Security number question. I found that this is left unanswered quite often. And reason being is that because the real Social Security number access request memo was submitted, some believe that it should satisfy what is needed for the questions pertaining to Social Security numbers on the HIPAA waiver, and it does not. You must, if you're using this form, it must be completed in totality. Again, this is your authority to access PHI for your research without the subject's authorization. Also, when you are submitting your DART request, please make sure that you answer these questions correctly, because these questions is what is going to prompt you to upload the necessary documents that's needed for your DART request. If they're not answered correctly, then your request may be sent back to you for you to answer the questions correctly, or we may ask for additional information or additional documentation. But to alleviate all of that, just take your time when you're answering these questions, just to make sure there's, you know, no delay in your request. So data use agreements are sometimes can be used for, we've seen that sometimes they're used, you know, in lieu of the memorandum of understanding. And DUAs, they are mandated by HIPAA when sharing a limited data set, and required by VHA policy when sharing VHA individual identifiable information or personal health information outside of VA. Now, there may be some prohibitions on using DUAs when sharing data internally to VA. And if there is any questions about when you should use a DUA, as was stated at the beginning of this presentation, you can most definitely, you could reach out to me, or another option is you can access the data use agreement page via the VHA data portal. So on this page, and you'll find you'll find DOAs. If you access the VHA data portal, you'll find DOAs under policy and admin. And this page is your one-stop shop to all things relating to DOAs. So on this page, what we have is we have a decision trees. So with the decision trees, it will assist with just determining if you need a DUA at all. You'll find a directive on there. We give you examples. We also have DUA templates, and each template is broken into a category. So you would just choose the template that that fits your project. Also, it has point of contact information as well. So if you can't, you know, remember who I am, you can most definitely email our DUA email group, and I will contact you. And, you know, we could either talk over Teams, or we could, you know, have a formal meeting about your project, whatever, you know, is you, whatever you're comfortable with. Then we could very well, you know, get that started to help with determining if you need a DUA. And here we have the VHA data portal. So the VHA data portal has some very useful information as it relates to just getting prepared for your research. So if you're not sure what data sources you need to use, if you click on data sources, it'll actually give you every single data source that we have with an explanation to that information as well. If you are not sure about how to access information, or if you have any questions about, you know, how to enter a DART request, this VHA data portal will be your go-to for all things data related to preparing for research. Another thing I want to mention that I didn't mention as it relates to the waiver. If it comes a time where you are in the middle of your research and you're thinking, oh, I could use another data source, and the data source you are looking to request was not a part of your initial DART request, we will then ask, did you submit another HIPAA waiver to add that data source to the list that we've already seen? And if your answer is no, then we are going to need either a waiver, or if your RB doesn't use a waiver, they use a memo, then that memo must explicitly state that they approved that data source and what was submitted to them. What was submitted to them to assist in making that determination. It's policy, it's law that if there is an, you know, amendment to your study as it relates to any of the information that you'll be accessing, a waiver should definitely, a new waiver should definitely be obtained if it was not a part of the initial request. And so that ends my presentation. I guess we'll open the line up for questions.
Thanks, Tamika. Yes, we do have some questions that have come in to the Q&A, so I will read those to you. Okay. I will read the ones that haven't been responded to yet.
Yes,
So one is they're asking for a link to the VHA data portal, and I think one of my colleagues will be able to provide that in the chat in just a moment. But the next question is, how would I know which SSN Hang on, so my screen got blocked for a second. I'm trying to read the whole thing. So I'll read that again. How would I know which SSN I should use? Real or the last four digits?
So that is up to the PI to decide. I will say when I was a privacy officer for Cleveland, and anytime that I reviewed a protocol and I found that they were using the last four, we would tell them just to replace the last four with the full social security number. And reason being is because you will find that you will have some subjects that may have the same last four and the same first initial of the last name. So for us, it was just easier to use the full social security number in the event that, they mistaken one veteran for another, or if, you know, you may have three or four individuals that are a part of the study that may use the last four, and then you may have one individual that may use the full social security number. So just to keep it consistent, I always told them to replace it with the full social security number. But again, that will be up to the PI, and you should definitely consult with your privacy officer as well to assist with making that determination.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
The next question is, how will I know if there's a problem with the privacy forms and or information submitted to DART?
We will submit to you a change request via DART. And then with that change request, we'll also give you some examples on how to fix your documentation. Sometimes, you know, just communicating via DART, you know, it doesn't work. So if at any time I need to have a meeting with a DART requester, we can definitely do that as well. But the first initial contact will be via DART through the change request process.
Thank you. The next question is, I believe earlier in the presentation, you said the templated HIPAA waiver was insufficient. Please comment how and why.
I said the templated language was insufficient.
Maybe the requester could send us a little more information about that question. Maybe it was misheard as well. So
okay.
I'm not sure.
They might be looking for that on that slide where you presented the different varieties of language that you see on IRB letters. Which one of them is the best that people, you know, which one meets the requirements?
Okay, so from my understanding, all four of those statements are okay. The issue is when you just have those four statements and nothing else. So with those four statements, you'll also need to have or list the identifiers, data sources, databases that you'll be accessing, along with the documentation that the IRB used to make the determination to grant the HIPAA waiver.
So, Tamika, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that those on their own, those items on their own aren't sufficient. But if you have the HIPAA waiver form and you've listed the, all of those things, that would be enough. And or if the IRB had listed all of the things that they, you know, the documents that they had checked and all the laws and regulations that were followed, would that be enough without the form? Or okay, do we always need to have that HIPAA waiver form for every request?
No. So two things can happen. Okay, you get, if you use the HIPAA form, perfect. If you don't use the HIPAA form and you rely on the IRB approval memo that consists of one of those four paragraphs that I showed, then you would also need to include the identifiers, the database, the databases, and the data sources to be used, along with the documentation that the IRB use to determine that they are going to grant the HIPAA waiver. What usually happens is with the IRB approval memo that is submitted as the waiver, and it doesn't meet all of the requirements per 1605.01 Privacy and Release of Information Directive Section 13, that's the research section, the waiver or the IRB memo does not meet those requirements. And so because that IRB memo does not meet those requirements, then additional information is needed to include the data sources, databases, identifiers that will be used for the project, along with the documentation used to help the IRB determine that they will grant the HIPAA waiver. Does that, is that a little bit more clear?
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. Cool beans.
Thanks, Tamika.
You're okay. Welcome.
The next question is first a comment. Thank you so much for this excellent presentation. The question is there a need for a separate DUA for statisticians who are hired through IPA or a contract? Unsure if these two options have different assumed privacy requirements.
You may need one. But the question so I can't fully answer that question to give you a concrete yes or no answer without a little bit more information. Because DUAs can be a little complicated, because it really, you know, depends on one, of course, who the information is going to. Two, how will you be transmitting that information? Three, you know, who's the data, who will be the data owner of that information? And so once that is all established, then we can go about making the determination if a DUA is needed. And so because DUAs can be, you know, complicated, you know, that's one of the reasons why, one, we have the DUA page with, you know, via the data portal, and two, you have a point of contact to assist with, you know, questions or concerns that, you know, you may have pertaining to your project if a DUA is needed. So the answer to the question is, yes, you may need a DUA, but I don't want to say, you know, that answer is definite without just a little bit more information.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The next question is about truly de-identified human subjects data. Is a DUA needed to be able to share this type of data set with the collaborator at the university affiliate?
If you're sharing de-identified information, then typically no, a DUA is not needed. But again, you know, more information would be needed. We just, you know, choose not to answer questions based on just a blanketed type of situation. So usually, you know, when we have questions pertaining to DUAs, there's always a need for a meeting. So, I mean, it may be needed, but again, you know, we'll just need like more meat to the question.
So a second part, a follow-up to that question just came in as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to just state this one. If the data is coded and the people at the affiliate do not have a link to that code, is the data still considered de-identified to the people you're sharing it with?
Yes. If the key to that information is kept with the PI, then you will be giving them de-identified information. So if the information that you're giving to a third party cannot be used to identify a subject, then we would consider that to be de-identified. However, if there's any questions about, you know, if the information is de-identified before you send it off to a third party, you could definitely contact your facility privacy officer to look it over just to make sure that it's de-identified.
Could I say something?
Yes.
So if, depending on what they mean by is coded, if they're just replacing direct identifier, one of the direct identifiers on the file, then that would, you know, it could constitute a limited data set rather than a de-identified data set. A de-identified data set would have to have all of the 18 elements of a safe harbor method or an expert determination, and that would remove all of the dates and geographical areas and you know, a lot of information that might make it usable for research at the affiliate. But if you have a limited data set where there, and that's a legal term, it's and you can find it in 1605.01, I think, then you have to have a DUA. But make sure, I think it's a great advice that Tamika gave, that you always check with your privacy officer at your facility before you share any data outside the VA. Thanks.
Thanks, Linda. Tamika, I have another question.
Okay.
So for projects making data requests that have a non-research determination, what privacy issues, considerations, or documentation might be needed?
Repeat that question one more time.
Sure. For projects making data requests that have a non-research determination, what privacy issues, considerations, and documentation might be needed?
Okay.
You want me to?
No. So it all depends. It all depends on what the purpose for the sharing of the data is. So if the sharing of the data is for, let's see, for example, you have a PI in Cleveland who is really good friends with another PI in Detroit. And the PI in Detroit wants, you know, wants data from the PI in Cleveland. And there's no establishment of any type of research going on between the two of them. To have access to that, for the Detroit PI to have access to that information, the best way to get that information would be to submit a Freedom of Information Act request through the facility FOIA officer. If the information is for treatment, payment, or any other healthcare operation, then you would probably or you should involve your privacy officer, because they can navigate you through what is the best route to get this information. Meaning, would it be to get this information through a written request, maybe? Or if this information could be shared under some other type of authority, such as an agreement between two offices in the form of maybe like a memorandum of understanding of some sort. So again, it would just all depends on the reason behind disclosing the information and to whom the information will be disclosed to.
Thank you. Next question. This might be for including Linda as well.
Okay.
Could you expand on number 18 of the HIPAA identifiers? It says, in quotes, other identifying numbers or quotes. That is very vague. For example, if I had a patient with an orange sticker and is labeled orange, but no one has the crosswalk, would that still be considered an identifier?
I don't think orange stickers are really covered in HIPAA.
No, they're not.
But there might be an identifier that say you have an employee number within the VA, I'm making this up. You know, if you have a number that identifies you uniquely, right?
Correct.
And so that would be not allowed. Go ahead, Tamika. Sorry. Yeah.
No, you're fine. So, for example, if a patient gets a heart monitor and the number on that heart monitor is specific to that patient, those numbers is an identifier because it's specific to that patient.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I think the last question is, so who's the best person to contact at my facility for questions about privacy, and how do I find them?
So the best individual to ask is your privacy officer. And if you do not know who that individual is, I will start with the IRB office, because the privacy officer and the IRB office, they work very, very, very closely together. So they should definitely know who your facility privacy officer is.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much. Tamika, could you hand the pointer back to me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. So thank you to Ms. Tamika Jefferson for taking the time to present today's session. reminding our attendees to please visit VIREC's main webpage for a link to our help desk and take form on REDCap to submit additional questions. Our next session for this series is on Wednesday, May 29th at 2 p.m. Eastern, and will be presented by Matt Medijewski, PhD, Senior Research Career Scientist, and the session is titled Notes to My Future Self, The Living Protocol. We hope to see you then. After leaving this session, a reminder that an evaluation will display on your monitor. Please take a few minutes to answer the questions. We do review each response and take your feedback into consideration when planning new sessions. Thank you again for attending today's session. We hope you plan to join us for the rest of our series. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.